yourself and one for your dreams.
Chapter 12. John. The Being Sensible and Realistic Job. John woke up to the sound of James Moriarty's voice. He blinked. A monitor was propped against the blurry wall. John swallowed. His mouth was dry. "Way I can shape a homes of my very own. Ah, Johnny Hero. We're going to have such fun together." John swallowed. The monitor blinked as it reset. "Surprise! I didn't kill you. I'm silly like that." And you should have seen Sherlock's face. Oh, he was surprised. I have to thank you. I didn't think I'd get to burn his heart twice. But with you, why, he grew a whole new heart. Isn't that lovely? I wanted to keep you ticking just for that. Why, all the ways I can play with our dear Sherlock. John blinked, his eyes focused. He recognized the room. Moriarty smiled. "By now, you'll have noticed where you are. You're welcome to a bit of the past, where it all started for you." The solid bedposts were the same. There was the same painting of an old sailing ship on the wall. He was in the room he'd so very briefly stayed in, at Adelbert's house in Cornwall. His wrists were tied to those same hooks on the bedposts. "But I love history. In the 1700s, an Omega could always escape the hangman if they pleaded their belly. It occurred to me then that it would be an awful shame to eliminate you before you had whelped. This way, I can shape a homes of my very own." The recording looped. "Himself is gone." Percy was sitting in a chair next to the bed. He'd been sitting so still that John hadn't even noticed him. "How could that bitch have even dared laid a finger on him?" Percy was crying. He'd been clearly crying for quite some time. His eyes were red-rimmed. He inhaled mucus that dripped from his red nose. He was holding a Sig Sauer in his hand that rubbed his nose. John smiled calmly. He needed to remain calm. "Hello, Percy. What's going on?" Percy waved the gun at the monitor. "That's all that's left of himself. That's all that's left of his genius." He shook his head. "Arrest of him. They abandon him, but I never will." He hiccuped against a sob. John was not feeling at his best. That was all he could think to say. Percy shook his head. "I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to let you watch him. I can't." Percy shook his head. He raised the gun. Bone and brains and blood. John jerked at his bonds, but they were tied quite tight. Right. He could lie there and be useless, or he could get out of this. John considered his options. He very carefully twisted his wrist and slowly unscrewed the hook that his left hand was tied to. That took a very long, nerve-wracking time. No one interrupted him. No one came to investigate the gunshot. He freed himself thread by painful twist. He searched Percy's pockets. He found a set of keys and a roll of money that must be nearly 3,000 quid. He took the money and the Sig Sauer. He staggered down the stairs. His head was pounding. He went by empty room after empty room. He kept expecting to meet someone. The house was very, very empty, in that it was full of dead bodies. Given the bluing around their lips and state of rigor, John estimated they'd been poisoned within the last 12 hours. John kept going. He set off down the extremely unnecessarily long driveway. It started to rain. He walked down the path along the river. It was very muddy. The path went up, the path went down. It rained harder. He walked up a hill that went on muddy forever. He walked into a town. A sandwich board sign on the corner declared, "Thief-Taker General," or Napoleon of crime. He had Percy's money. He bought the paper. He bought all the papers. The headline screamed in large fonts. It seemed he'd lost about a week. Irene had dealt the first blow to Moriarty, but evidence of his dastardly deeds was continuously forthcoming. Government officials were shocked. There were article after article about the evidence of paperwork for art forgery found in Moriarty's home, how this had been the linchpin of a vast criminal organization. Sales of forged art were used to launder funds. Stolen art was used to stimulate the sale of forged art. Laundered funds from every type of crime that existed. The papers had pages of ink on the dire deeds that the Napoleon of crime had invented. He paid to use a creaky old computer to go online. Breaking news detailed the mystery of Moriarty's death. He'd been on life support, his condition improving. Someone had tampered with the machine, pumping blood into his veins. Another site said he'd overdosed. Another site claimed that the Napoleon of crime was actually the clone of Napoleon. In all cases, officials were investigating. John was shocked, or perhaps he was in shock. It was over. John sat there drinking tea and reading the articles over and over again. Then he read them again. It was over. It didn't mean that he could walk back into his life. It meant he had no idea what it meant. The marvelous adventure was done. He wasn't quite sure what he should do. He walked back to the house. He buried the bodies in the garden near where he'd killed the guards. There was a very convenient mini-garden tractor thing with very simple controls. It took longer to move some bushes over the bodies, but he thought the result looked nice. It reminded him of mass graves he'd seen. He'd seen too many. But they were not going to get a proper burial, not Moriarty's men. He stood up and stretched his back. He held his hand against the small of his back at the burning muscles there. He looked up at the ledge 3 stories up and thought how unreal that all seemed. In a sort of odd malaise that he couldn't really have described if he'd been asked, he waited. He didn't know what he was waiting for. He was dead, but Sherlock was Sherlock. He obsessively watched the news. The house had electricity. He moved from room to room. He had no idea for how long. He watched Moriarty's web fall apart. He thought about calling Sherlock. He was angry and dull by turns. He glared at the walls. He watched the news report of Irene's dramatic release from prison and Sherlock's more dramatic escape. Her tragic death during a camping trip to her home in America? Yeah. The report said that she was eaten by wolves. John considered the idea of Irene in the woods, and thought that maybe, now that John was out of the way, that perhaps Irene and Sherlock? He tried not to think about it. That was hard, as there was already a song about the whole thing, overplayed everywhere. John came to the rather horrible realization that he was going to have to go on with his life. It felt like time had stopped, but it sure as hell was speeding up with a vengeance. His body wouldn't let him stay still. The reality was, he had to face reality. After the Bond movie ended, the Bond Omega left the stage to make way for the next movie. He pulled himself together and called his sister. She had wavering hysterics. It seemed he was responsible for her going back to drink. He was responsible. He kept hearing those words in his head. He almost called Sherlock. He almost called Molly. He didn't. He wasn't even sure what to say. Sorry, I didn't actually fake my own death, but I did hang around pretending to be dead for an additional month because I was feeling sorry for myself. Sorry? He didn't call. He didn't write. He had the rather horrible realization that he wasn't fine. that this wasn't right, that he'd been not fine for any of it. He wanted so very much to ask for what he'd wanted. He didn't say anything. Time continued to stand still. Time was also speeding up. Right. John could face reality. He could eat up practical. He found a place to stay. He filled in the application with his own name and details, and expected any minute for Sherlock to sweep in and take the decision out of his hands. He did not. The place was an off-season vacation rental that perched by the sea, but the owner had always had trouble renting it out. It was beyond cheap. It had no mobile coverage. It had no electric. The place was below basic, but when the owner asked if he'd be fine out there, he'd laughed. He could hear the sea. He thought it just might be a perfect place to think for a little while. He said he'd be fine. He sat on the porch and looked at the view. He went for long walks. He said hello to the people he passed on the rolling hills and hedged-in lanes. He helped a farmer deliver a lamb in a field next to some ancient dolmen. He sat on his porch. He wrote. It wasn't really the story of what had happened. He changed the names. He toned down the amount of sex. It felt good, though, to be writing. It defined what happened. In writing, he was finally able to explain to himself his own feelings. When he was done, he sent it to his agent, who had hysterics at him. He decided to use a pen name. He went in for his prenatal checkup and got to talking with Dr. Netherton, the old beta doctor who ran the clinic by himself. Talking led to lunch and somehow got him a job without so much as a CV. Dr. Netherton told him he'd heard about the lamb. Everyone had heard about the lamb. The Omegas and Tridenic Wallace cooed over him and called him a lamb. They asked him when his little lamb was due. He smiled. His lips were too numb to feel like cracking. He kept up his walking. It was why he was nearby when the housekeeper at Tregennis B&B recorded the strange happenings there. He went in, inhaled one breath, and ordered everyone out now. After that, Constable Gray put him up for a pint. He made his milk. "I still can't believe you recognize that poison just based on the smell." John drank his milk. "I've been around." He didn't say he'd been the first on scene. When a group of soldiers decided to test the effects of Devil's Root, they thought they were going to get high. Not a beta among them over 19. Most of them had been on their first tour. He smiled and walked around the outside. He chatted with Morty Tregennis. He was just a pregnant Omega. He was no threat. He was actually not half bad at figuring things out. It felt too late for those kind of feelings. He half expected someone to say something during Morty Tregennis's trial, but no one questioned him on the stand. He was Dr. Lamb Watson, or just Dr. Lamb. Mr. Roundhay, the local vicar, smiled softly and quoted Tiger Tiger at him. Life kept going forward. The months rolled on. By the time his little girl came into the world, he was more than done with the whole business. There wasn't really a question of what she'd be called. He looked down at Charity, who gurgled and smiled at him. Life kept going forward. Time passed. He found himself running into Mr. Roundhay on his morning walks. Roundhay talked to him about some bit of local history, the local dolmen or pirates. Still, it surprised him in late summer. Past a year then since his life went out the window. Roundhay asked him out on a date. He told himself to be practical. He told himself to be realistic. Time was still standing still for John. He looked at where Charity was trying to decide if she wanted to eat dolmen dirt. "Afraid I'm still hung up on this one's father." He knew that time was standing still because he felt the moment the world started to turn again. He'd been in the park. Charity was tearing around in circles. He grinned at Corrine. They didn't tell me she'd go straight from crawling to running. He turned back to Charity and stopped. What he felt wasn't even remotely a practical feeling. It wasn't even remotely a realistic feeling. He looked across the park at where Charity was looking up at Sherlock, who was looking down at her. He felt time stutter to life. He thought, oh. He thought, I am an idiot. He swallowed. That voice inside his head said he should be practical and reasonable. And he told that voice to go fuck itself. He walked to where everything that was important in his life was waiting.